I was thinking actually ahead of this discussion, I was thinking I would kind of ambush you, and so maybe we can start there.
Okay.
Which is to say, Doug, would you join me in forming a political movement for the dictatorship of the proletariat in the United States?
Well, okay.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Cotrone is a college educator, writer, and media artist committed to critical thinking and artistic practice and the politics of social emancipation. Cotrone is the original lead organizer of the Platypus Affiliated Society, is the author of the controversial essays Why Not Trump and Why Not Trump Again. But lately, specifically after encountering a Twitter movement calling itself the anti-left, he appears to me to be a good leftist after all. Chris Cotrone, welcome to the Zero Books channel.
Hi, Doug.
Hey. So thanks for coming back again. I'm hoping that we can talk about some of the problems that the left faces today, but through an historical lens at first, and then in the parrot room, we can talk about, well, we can talk about this anti-left trend that I'm seeing, the aftermath of the Sanders campaign, and how to be in the contemporary left and not of it, maybe. So that would be what people who become patrons can watch. I just want to pitch that at the very beginning, the Patreon. Okay. let's talk about, well, first of all, we were both part of a Platypus Affiliated Society panel on critical theory today, and critical theory after Trump or after the failure of the Sanders campaign, depending on how you want to look at it. I enjoyed participating. It was frustrating at times. I found myself at odds with some of the people on the panel who I didn't expect to be at odds with. I just was wondering what your general impression was of the critical theory panel, and maybe you could describe what it was for to start with.
Okay, so that was an event that was part of our annual international convention in Platypus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the two sort of headline public panel discussions in terms of topics were the Platypus Synthesis. So there was a panel on Trotskyism and a panel on critical theory, and the history and death of the millennial left. So there were two panels there, one with Platypus members and one with other speakers on the left. Our panel was the critical theory part of the Platypus Synthesis, pair of panels, the other one again being on Trotskyism. And both of those panels were a little frustrating, actually, in a way that I was both surprised by, but also not surprised by. So, in our panel, there was a cross discussion going on. So Dennis Gramer, who represents the Association for the Design of History, a German group, activist group, but kind of theory group also, kind of typical of the German left, and Douglas Kellner, who is a longtime Frankfurt School scholar, was asked, I suppose, to represent, Marcuse and that side of things in terms of the relationship between the 60s New Left and critical theory, and then us, right? So that was the four panelists. And there were several different conversations going on. And obviously I made the intervention that I sought to make in my opening remarks on the negative dialectic of Marxism. I tasked myself with speaking on Adorno in a way that I haven't previously. I took it as an opportunity to specify the necessity of the dialectic for Marxism, however negatively, through the way Adorno treats it and tracing that back to Marx and Lenin and others. Mm-hmm. But to really elicit a response either from you or from the other panelists. And so I was eager to have this discussion with you today to maybe, you know, get into that, because I know that you've spent a lot of time thinking about, reading, and also publicly speaking about critical theory, Frankfurt School, Adorno, etc. Also Marcuse, right? Like that. Didn't you have a discussion about Mataibbi and Marcuse?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that you have like a sustained engagement on this topic, and so I would be interested in getting into more depth with you about it. You've also talked, publicly about Lukács, and you know, like the deep roots of critical theory, rather than just the Frankfurt School, but like the pre-Frankfurt School critical theory mm-hmm. tradition. And obviously, you and I have a long history of dialogue about various topics, but also, you know, specifically, I know what you and Derek Varn and others consider to be, or Ben Burgess consider to be, peculiarities of Platypus in our emphasis mm-hmm. on various aspects of Marxism. And so I'm here to represent that, if at all possible. And in terms of your most recent video on the anti-left mm-hmm. and on the possibility of reconstituting a socialist left, I was thinking actually ahead of this discussion, I was thinking I would kind of ambush you. And so maybe we can start there.
Okay.
Which is to say, you know, Doug, would you join me in forming a political movement for the dictatorship of the proletariat in the United States?
Well, okay. But what is it? I mean, are there dues, membership dues? What is it involved?
It involves discipline. In other words, we got to get serious about making the dictatorship of the proletariat happen in the United States within some foreseeable, conceivable historical horizon. So, maybe you and I wouldn't live to see it, but maybe your son would.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I still have some hopes that Aubrey de Grey is going to come to my rescue. But barring that, you know who he is? He's a longevity researcher.
Yeah. I don't know about that. I mean, I don't have a problem with mortality. I do have a problem with historical legacy, however. In other words, I have no problem with my own personal mortality. I have a problem with, what I have done with my life that transcends my mere personal existence.
Well, I think a part of the reason why I hold out hope for Aubrey de Grey is because I feel like I am so far behind in my own personal project for my life. You know,
we all are. You know, in other words, we've all, as Adorno put it, wasted our lives.
Yeah, I feel that pressing upon me. But the other reason why
that's not a personal failure. That's capitalism. In other words, and we can talk about that too, about history and capitalism and how capitalism makes it such that we all waste our lives.
Yeah, but the other reason why I'm big with Aubrey de Grey is because I believe something that Woody Allen said is true. Woody Allen was asked in the movie in one of the more autobiographical movies.
Sleeper.
No, not Sleeper.
Point. Okay.
No, it was it was one of his less popular movies. He played a film director in it. It will come to me, the title, in a moment. But this is obviously a sign of my age that I can't call it to mind. But anyway,
age that you're talking about Woody Allen.
That's true as well.
Nobody knows who Woody Allen is except us.
Well, no, people know who Woody Allen is.
Only
they know
for
that
the
he,
sex scandal, not for right. anything else.
Right.
Not for the films.
Yeah, but in this film, he plays a director and he's taking questions from the audience, and one of them says to him, "Would you like to live on in your work? Is that you know, you talk a lot about death. Are you trying to achieve immortality through your work?" And he says, "Well, actually, I prefer to achieve immortality by not dying." So that's how I'm with him on that. The neurotics approach.
Also, his films are very much of their historical moment. And so they may not have historical longevity. They might not have even sought to have much historical longevity. In other words, they're very much interventions in the film culture of his time. And which says something about art, too. It's a peculiarity, because I've wondered about that, too. I've wondered, will my legacy be in my art, in my more creative work, or will it be in my ideas, or, you know, like, what is one's legacy? How is it, you know?
All right. So, talking personally a little bit, I've written 3 novels and 2 short story collections, and no one's read those. Very much, you know, this novel here behind me, it's probably a couple thousand people who've read that novel. Whereas on YouTube, I've had a much bigger impact. So I guess as I'm my legacy are my YouTube videos.
Yeah, which, but those are more ephemeral than a novel.
I know, that's right. So I'm not sure about my cultural legacy. I feel as though I'm not done yet. So we'll see. But
no, we're not done. We're not done. But we got to think about what we have to contribute now, because now that we really are the older generation, you know, with the passing of the boomer generation, we're the older generation now.
Yeah, they're not all dead yet. Unfortunately,
they're not really. They're not really creative or productive anymore.
I think they had a last moment
maybe about 15 years ago. So when Platypus started, it did seem like the New Left generation had one more round of like reconsideration, rethinking, like productive creativity, but not since then, I don't think.
On the dictatorship of the proletariat, I am definitely willing to sign up for that if we can work out just a little bit what the aims of the dictatorship of the proletariat are going to be. And rather than
dominate global capitalism. In other words, the workers of the United States taking control and leadership of global capitalism and prosecuting the revolution everywhere.
I'm just concerned about state capitalism. You know, I've got
You got to be concerned about that. I mean, I would say the left, probably most people on the left would reject my offer to join a movement for the dictatorship of the proletariat in the United States, because they'd immediately have the specter of Trump voters. Like, would you want those people to be dictating to the world? I would say, no, really, because most people think the working class is straight white men. And so the image that they have in their mind, wrongly, of course, is this kind of like, oh, you wouldn't want the dictatorship of the proletariat in the United States, because imagine if you unleashed the working class of the United States as a revolutionary force aggressively upon the world, right? Like, in other words, it would look like Biden and Kamala Harris and even Trump are a lot safer than unleashing the deplorables and the irredeemables on the world.
My concern is the opposite. I worry that what is called a dictatorship of the proletariat will really be the domination of a state party.
And of course, that's the euphemism, right? So I was going to say, would you join my movement for a socialist party? The problem is that that's a euphemism. It's a euphemism for the dictatorship of the proletariat. And, you know, so really cut to the chase, right? Like, what are we really proposing? But of course, to implement the dictatorship of the proletariat, we'd need a party. And that doesn't mean that that party wouldn't have competitors, wouldn't have other parties maybe alongside it or splitting off from it or what have you, that there wouldn't be a lot of political controversy around it. It doesn't mean that that wouldn't be the case, but it would mean a party, at least a party, probably multiple parties, all claiming to want to achieve this goal. And, you know, again, would that risk state capitalism? It very much would risk that, of course. It would risk, just as in the history of Marxism, the party as a revolutionary force would risk becoming a counter-revolutionary force. It would, necessarily. That's the risk you have to take.
Yeah, I understand. And a bit. I understand a bit of what you're saying. I feel as though I'm on board, especially if we can create a movement where debating the ideas and the role that the party should take and looking through the history is a part of
if project. If it were vital, like, then debate would be unavoidable, right?
Right.
Like, if it were really vital as a political force, then, you know, internal debate and struggle would be inevitable. It would not only be desirable, it would be necessary.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm on board. The questions I have are coming up in the context of it not being vital, right?
Like, right.
In the context,
and the DSA not being it.
Well, yeah, you but know, did anyone? No right. one actually thought the DSA was going to be it.
I don't know if we had the Jacobin editorial board on right now with us, they might pay some lip service to the dictatorship of the proletariat. They might. I mean, if they were honest, they would say that they're against it. But I'm afraid they wouldn't be honest, right? So the closest thing I've gotten to honesty from them is a kind of indirect debate that I had with Bhaskar Sankara and Leo Panitch last year over Lenin, in which they were defending Ralph Miliband against Lenin and basically saying, well, in Lenin's time, yeah, you'd want the civil social organizations of the working class to build themselves up to be able to replace the capitalist state. And they said, well, no, now the capitalist state is a very different thing and we can't hope to do that. And so we have to try to capture the capitalist state instead. And they use Ralph Miliband as the, you know, he's the real inspiration. Although Jacobin will pay lip service to Lenin, they will. But really, their attitude is much more Ralph Miliband. And so they, you know, when they're honest, they frankly reject revolution and they reject the dictatorship of the proletariat or mealy-mouth it into some kind of like workers' democracy or whatever that means, which just means like the Democratic Party getting the working class vote.
Right. Well, it hasn't this been in some guys a debate within Marxism from the beginning in a way because of the like
not
you know
really.
The different
not really.
No like
no,
Bernstein
Edward,
wasn't
no,
advocating
Edward Bernstein was for the dictatorship of the proletariat. He was, in other words, even his kind of revisionist reformism, his kind of evolutionary socialism, is predicated on the working class being an organized social and political force. It really is predicated on that. He just thought, you know, we could bypass the revolution, you know, in the 1848 style kind of political crisis of the state, that might be avoidable and it might be desirable to avoid that because maybe when the Proletarian Socialist Party is elected to power, it would be based outside the state on the civil social power. This broad working class, like social power beyond its.
What kind of institutions were a part of that? Or was that about radical unions? Yeah.
Unions, but everything, you know, because of course in that time, so it was women's organizations, and this is before women had the right to vote. Mm-hmm. So the women got the right to vote as soon as the SPD came to power in the German Revolution of 1918. Right. Mm-hmm. That was one of the first things that they did was give women the vote, right? Because obviously that's the Marxist program. But, you know, women's organizations, of course, all sorts of educational, you know, organizations for the working class, cultural organizations for the working class, workers' cooperatives. And, of course, like unions, but within a broader context of, that they did foresee, you know, obviously Edward Bernstein, he never like rejected the Paris Commune or anything like that. Mm-hmm. He saw the possibility, the necessity, even the desirability of a broadening of political democracy, right, which could be facilitated by a working class majority with an existing democracy. I mean, what he had in mind, of course, was not really Germany. He thought that a revolution might still be necessary in Germany because Germany was an autocracy. It was the Prussian Empire. He was thinking more of England, France, and the United States. Where they're democratic republics, basically. I mean, England, you know, obviously is not, it's a monarchy. But, you know, France and the United States are democratic republics. And so he thought it's very plausible that by the time a proletarian socialist party got an electoral majority, it would be powerful enough in civil society to not make a revolution necessary.
Yeah, I guess.
And that's true. You know, that is true.
The similarity, I guess, for me is the way in which political power replaces the true and full dictatorship of the proletariat in his thought. because the transformation of the workplace, the transformation of distribution and production, both isn't, he doesn't seem to think it's necessary. And that's because he's revising Marx.
Well, you know, Orthodox Marxism is not really for workplace democracy. It has no problem with single man management or whatever, right? Like, controversially. Right. So it's not syndicalism.
No.
It's not. And so, because basically it foresees that even in the dictatorship of the proletariat, there will be a conflict between workers and managers, and that, it wasn't foreseen that managers will have to be a member of the party, what happened in the Soviet Union, nor was it imagined that the unions would be absorbed by the party either. Right. So the party is for like certain political things, and then the unions are for something else. And then there are these like managerial elements that you have to be winning over, both at a social level and at a political level. And, you know, so you wouldn't want to get rid of basically the kind of technical engineering class of people. That's the most efficient way to manage production, actually.
The way I think of it is sort of maybe a little woo-woo or, a little naive, but I imagine that, under communism, you would still have conductors of orchestras.
Certainly.
Right? You would want people might want to participate in an orchestra in a different way, and they would still need someone to conduct. So the same thing's true of a workplace. You might need a manager. Factory. Yeah, a factory. But the fact is that it would be a free participation, not based on exploitation. Huh?
You eliminate exploitation just by raising the wage and lowering the hours. In other words, that's really...
See, this is where I don't know we can do that, right? This is where I have a difference with you, because I think that as long as you're doing commodity production, there are going to be unintended consequences of that will...
There are.
Objective forces push against...
That's true.
Those kinds
of... That's absolutely true. So in other words, like, under the dictatorship of the proletariat, there will be a spontaneous tendency to reconstitute capitalism. And it will have to be fought against consciously, deliberately, mostly at a political level, but also at a civil-social level, and those aren't the same thing. In other words, there might still be strikes, of course, under the dictatorship of the proletariat, labor union strikes. There would also be, like, laws, right? The state would seek to transform capitalist production through like policies and laws, at the same time that at a civil social level practices would change, right? So but again, it's not like anarcho-syndicalism, right? It's not like, okay, we just dissolve society into its constitutive parts and make every part of it, like Paracon or something.
Paracon is. I'm about to publish a new book on Paracon.
Good.
And
critical.
Yeah. Well, no, it's Michael Albert's book. I'm about to publish Michael Albert's Paracon.
You're about to publish him. So
yes.
Okay. Well, but that's good. At least it's being,
Well, my goal is to get the book out there and then publicize it through Ruthless Criticism.
Yeah.
To try to get him to engage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, get him to engage with Marxist criticisms and other criticisms to really put it out there and test it out. I admire Paracon in some ways, but I don't think that it would ultimately function. But I also find it difficult to get Michael Albert to even consider something like the tendency to rate of profit to decline, which is like my go-to, but it's like, I can't get him to consider Marxist categories. I mean, he rejects them. He doesn't believe in the labor theory of value.
That's right. So yeah. I mean, he and Graeber, like anarchists, sometimes they agree with Marx. Often they don't. Often they're just Proudhonians or, have their own sort of modified version of that. And these are old disputes. They go back to the 1840s, go back to Marx's critique of Proudhon. And, rather than thinking of it as like a theory, like a kind of disputing the labor theory of value, I think it's best to think of it politically. What's the vision here? And because the anarchists are so fixated on getting rid of hierarchy and centralization, you know, they really kind of miss the point, I think. You know, and, you know, again, accumulation, concentration, centralization of capital, which is not the same thing as political control or centralized authority, but but is related, of course. I think that, you know, capital accumulation, capital concentration, you know, that's also a spontaneous tendency. In other words, that's something, you know, that you can't, I mean, basically what it boils down to is commodity production cannot be abolished in one stroke. And I mean, of course, like a Michael Albert or an anarchist perspective in general, I mean, you know, just speaking as a Marxist, I would say that they're not aiming to abolish commodity production at all.
Right.
They're actually aiming to restore it. They're aiming to restore small production, bourgeois small production. And that's a conservative reactionary dream. You know, it's a dream that everybody has. The libertarians, you know, liberal, you know, like old style liberals, conservative liberals, you know, they bemoan the big corporations and the state and all those things without ever, you know, actually understanding why those things come into existence other than as like evils that just sort of happen and we have to be against them or something.
You know, it's funny. I'm about to publish two books that are kind of from the 80s and 90s. One is this Perricon book. That's a recapitulation of the Perricon argument. The other is a memoir about the formation of a magazine called Mondo 2000. Do you remember Mondo 2000? So it's this cyberpunk, California hippie, techno-utopian vision that you know, on acid that,
when was this published? It's 90s.
The Mondo 2000 magazine was sort of like a precursor to Wired, but it was, you know, if Wired was on acid and it was like, so you'd have articles about cyber sex as a utopian dream. And
as opposed to a dystopian nightmare.
Right. Cause
but every utopian dream of technology under capitalism turns out in reality to be a dystopian nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we can look at Mondo 2000 and all the hippie psychedelic dreams of the techno utopia that came out from Timothy Leary and others. And we can see them as reality now.
Realized.
Yeah. Right. So it's going to be a fun project to publish these two books, and in a way that's both celebrating their ambition and critiquing them, you know.
Yeah, it's important sort of historical, you know, marking a beat, you know, like, okay, because, you know, we are kind of seeing a certain playing out of the 90s now, right? In other words, crisis of neoliberalism, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there are two births to neoliberalism in the 70s. But also in the 90s. So there's like a kind of a turn to neoliberalism starting in the 70s, but you don't really get like unobstructed neoliberalism until the 90s. So you get the groundwork being laid, but, you know, it's like the 90s is the chance for it to really have its opportunity. You know, so I always said that when Trump said, "Make America Great Again," people thought he meant the 1950s. But he meant the 1990s.
Did he? I thought you meant the 1980s.
No, because the 1980s were still the Cold War. It was still a problem. Hmm. And I think that, so he supported Ross Perot in 1992. And, he, you know, he's maintained that perspective of being against, you know, unlimited trade, etc. But he, even though he was opposed to like Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush, but ultimately he kind of supported Clinton. Like he supported Reagan, but he supported Clinton too, Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I think his vision, and I also think the vision of the people that he speaks to who support him, are, okay, let's go back to the prosperity we had in the 90s before all these inexplicable disasters happened, like the war on terror, because obviously Trump's the anti-war candidate. Mm-hmm. Still. And, you know, the Great Recession. So, you know, I would say the two parties really discredited themselves through the war on terror and the Great Recession.
I think I have a distorted view of the 90s because I was part of the anarchist Pacific Northwest left at the time. So I saw the 90s as a time of great misery for most people, right? I remember in the towards the late 90s when people, friends of mine, were saying, hey, you know, you've been working that shit job for a long time. You should go out and get another one because you could.
You could.
Now.
Yeah. I also failed to do that. I was very miserable in my 20s and the 90s. I was. Yeah. I missed out on the prosperity, but I was aware of the fact that it was going on around me.
Yeah, I was only partially aware of it. And it was because I was coming of age at that time in the early 90s and, you know, all that. But I was definitely...
I think just, young adulthood has been a struggle for people for a while. Right. Like that's mm-hmm. something that definitely the millennials have faced and the Zoomers might face too. Maybe not.
They're definitely going to face it. No, the Zoomers are going to face it, I think. Yeah.
I mean, maybe I have two norms, like new norms now that it's understood that everybody works a shit job until they're like in their 30s.
Maybe. Oh, okay. Maybe. But I know that just getting the shit job is not going to be as easy as it used to be either.
That's how you get people to take the shit jobs is make them hard to get.
Yeah, I have a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old still at home, and then a 22-year-old and a 24-year-old who are out in Eugene, are living around the university, either having completed it or sort of dropping out and going back in. And none of them are looking, you know, like for Gen X, the idea that we were going to have Mick jobs and we weren't going to be as rich as our parents was a shock.
It was a shock.
For my kids... It's like the fact that one of them might get a relatively stable middle-class job is like some sort of miracle right now.
That's the new norm is that people are meant to feel lucky to have a job at all. It's really
right.
Good.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, I have all these prepared questions and we haven't gotten to any of them and I don't feel bad about that particularly, but I wanted to ask you, let's see, about the dictatorship of the proletariat and how we get to it. This is a question that's aiming to maybe touch on that. The Christopher Lash book, The Agony of the American Left, describes the early 20th century socialist movement as having been strong up until sometime after 1917 when its left wing revolted. It was, according to Lash, the belief that the Bolsheviks' success could be duplicated in America that undid the American socialist movement. The belief of the moderates was that the war was not a revolutionary opportunity, but had weakened the prospects for socialism. And unlike the socialists in Europe, the socialists in the U.S. had not supported the war, nor the post-war attacks on the Soviet Union, but they were kind of perceived to be in the same boat as the SPD, you know, the mm-hmm. Social Democrats in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Lash is correct about what did end the socialist movement in the United States in the early 20th century? Can we be too quick to try to move to revolution? And should we have patience?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if that's exactly what he was saying. I think the problem with Lash, I mean, I read Lash a long time ago. And at the behest of, at the recommendation of Adolf Reed, he said, you should read Christopher Lash. So the two books were The Agony of the American Left and The Culture of Narcissism.
Mm-hmm. And, those are the two books I read in the 90s as well.
Yeah, and in the 90s. This is when Adolf told me to read them, you know, post-college. And they definitely impacted me, but I also recognized that these works were conservative critiques of the left. They were valid, but they were also from the right. And, you know, certainly Adolf understood that too. So the question is, could we address these problems, but from the left as opposed to from the right, which is where Lash was going. And I would say Lash is right and wrong. And insofar as he's wrong in the way that many on the left are wrong, which is that they think that there were avoidable mistakes or errors that took place that if only that wrong turn hadn't happened, things could have worked out better. And I do think that we need to understand the necessity of these crises and failures and defeats, however you want to, or failures, really, on the left. In other words, there was a crisis of Marxism, of the socialist movement in World War I and in the revolutions that followed. There was a crisis. There was a, you know, it's like a real thing. It's not like a mistake or a sellout or a betrayal. It's a real crisis in which the people on all sides of the issue had a good reason to think that they were in the right, meaning that not the political right, but in the right, you know, the moral.
Yeah,
right.
They were correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the political right, in the sense of like, this is what was necessary to do politically. They also all thought that from the standpoint of socialism, in other words, when the SPD put down the Spartacus uprising in Germany, they thought that they were serving the goal of socialism in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's
actually too easy to pretend like we have a view where we can adjudicate those issues today.
We can't. No, it's like, so what we have to do rather is see the substance of the conflict. In other words, what is expressed in that conflict? Like, what's the real historical substance of this crisis of Marxism that took place? You know, that Marxism was authentically, you know, divided against itself. And, you know, you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It's not about like, you know, just sort of, oh, if only there's this split hadn't happened, if only this crisis hadn't taken place. It's rather how to work through that crisis. And of course, that crisis was political, meaning it's a political conflict. And so how could that political conflict have been prosecuted? You know, it's not just, oh, well, the communists should have won. You know, the Bolsheviks should have won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think that, you know, people like Luxembourg and Lenin and Trotsky, like these figures, I think that they understood that this was a process. You know, that there was a real political struggle and that they themselves could find themselves on the wrong side of history, too.
You know, when I recently read about the German Revolution, I was reading some academic articles in order to, you know, I do all this sort of research on the fly to make these videos. So like, sure. I'm constantly educating myself. But one of the things that I read was that, you know, Luxembourg and her crew were not ready politically to lead. Like the workers were out in the streets. They were revolting. They were resisting, but there was no solid political project.
That's right. So the Spartacus Bund was not a party and it didn't have the resources to discipline the revolutionary struggle. And what they aimed to do in December and January in 1918-1919 was actually to do what the Bolsheviks did in July of 1917, which is to support the workers in their uprising, but also prevent their defeat from being catastrophic, because they did think it was premature, in the same way the Bolsheviks in July 1917 thought that the workers' uprising was premature, but they still joined the struggle with the workers, even though they thought it was premature. And that's in order to be able to, you know, beat an orderly retreat. And unfortunately, the Spartacus Bund, it's not like they were going to take power in January 1919, but they were also not strong enough to assert the political discipline necessary to beat an orderly retreat and to basically learn from the defeat, right? And then to use that as preparation for some kind of future struggle and perhaps victory. That's why Luxembourg's speeches at the founding of the Communist Party of Germany, she said, look, we're just in the beginning of the revolution. And we're not going to come to power until the end of the revolution. Right. And so, And this has been misinterpreted to be like anti-vanguardist or anti-putschist, but actually that's her interpretation of when the Bolsheviks came to power. In other words, she saw the Bolsheviks having come to power at the end of a process rather than at the beginning of a process, meaning they came to power when the Tsarist state and the provisional government had fully exhausted themselves. And that was not the case yet with the Reich's government, you know, the state, the Prussian state was still there, the military, the police, and the SPD, you know, which was the regime that was governing, ruling over just the regime over the existing Prussian autocratic state, which remained the state in the Weimar Republic too. It was never smashed. It was never overthrown. And it neither it nor the SPD exhausted themselves, as it turned out. Or they only exhausted themselves, they gave way to the right. In other words, when the SPD lost governing authority, it's because they were replaced by right-wing parties in the Weimar Republic. And so Luxembourg, I think, was very sober about it. And she did, you know, take the Russian example seriously, even if she knew it wouldn't be exactly replicated. You know, and of course, the workers' uprising, you know, there's another factor in there, which is the revolutionary shop stewards, the people who had led the strikes against the war production in 1916, and who were suspicious of all the parties, including the Spartacus Bund, you know, and the USPD and the SPD. And, you know, I think Lenin, Trotsky, Luxembourg were not just fanatical revolutionists, which is the way their detractors and their fans, their supporters, mistake them to be. And so I know that you wanted to talk about determinism and voluntarism.
Yeah.
Right.
But before we get to that, let me ask you, I want to say something about Christopher Lash.
They're not voluntarists. They're not voluntarists. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get to that. Maybe we can cover that a little more in the parent room as well. But I just want to say about Christopher Lash. You said that he was critiquing the left from the right. And I want to quibble with that. I think he was critiquing the left from maybe the right side of the left. He was a socialist. I don't think he was a
conservative. Sure. No, he's like a right social democrat in that moment.
Yeah, and he's being picked up right now by forces that are actually, I think, on the right side of the American political perspective.
Conservative liberal perspective in the American.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So they grasp. That's because they like, you know, his criticism of the counterculture and that kind of thing, and his defense of the family.
And it's his book, The Revolt of the Elites, which is his last book and his most conservative book, is one that they champion. And I keep saying, yeah, he got to read Agony of the American Left. Yeah.
But you know, The Revolt of the Elites is good too, because, you know, the point of the matter is that progressive capitalism is not at any stretch a leftist thing. Progressive capitalism, like, you know, the kind of radical chic type, you know, stuff that comes out of the 60s, you know, they are our enemies. They are.
I agree. I totally agree enemies, with that. But, you know, but.
And that's what happened now.
Well, I know. But what happens is the whole left project gets lumped in with this.
That's because the left has been a fringe tail on that. In other words, the left really has been just the shock troops for the progressive elites and the progressive capitalists. And, you know, the radical chic of woke capitalism that we're going.
But how far back does that go, do you think?
I think it goes back to the 30s. You know,
so would that mean the Frankfurt School was that as well?
The Frankfurt School and the Trotskyists are the ones who resisted that. And of course, Lash comes out of that orbit, right? He comes out of the orbit of like the Shakmanite kind of tradition of Trotskyism and, you know, that kind of like, you know, Bayard Rustin kind of, you know, I don't know what you'd call them, social democrats, I suppose, but, you know, like, you know, they were realistic. And certainly they had aspirations beyond the role that they played, you know, which was some kind of, I don't know, Hubert Humphreyism or something, you know, or like part of the way with LBJ or whatever. You know, I think that they're realistic about the U.S. not being on the brink of a socialist revolution in the 1960s, you know, and so, you know, pseudo-radicalism is a real problem because it provides cover for support for progressive capitalism. And that's been true since the 30s. That's been true since the Stalinized Communist Party in the 1930s.
You know? Yeah, I just worry that realization can lead over to the idea that anything that sounds or comes from the left, no matter what it says, is basically just providing cover for class enemies. You know, when
you have to take on board the idea that maybe everything on the left now is right as presently constituted. And, you know, really, this is
my t-shirt. Exposed.
I mean, you know, I just, you know, I kind of feel like it isn't kind of patently obvious. Right. And so the question is how the left dissembles about that, meaning like clearly that is what the left is. And they lie about it. That's the real problem, is that, you know, if they were just progressive capitalists, fine, you know, there's a place for that in the world. In other words, like, obviously, you're going to have, like, politics and capitalism, and there are going to be progressives and conservatives. And, you know, I wrote about this going back to the Gilded Age era and progressivism. And the question with progressivism and conservatism is, who's really conservative? Like, maybe the progressives are just the best conservatives in terms of maintaining capitalism. And also, maybe the conservatives are more progressive than the avowed progressives in their faith in, like, bourgeois society, right? That they couldn't put their faith in bourgeois freedom. And after all, I mean, you know, I always like to point out that Debs, that socialist party, was not in any way necessarily closer to the Democrats than the Republicans. In some ways, mm-hmm. they were closer to the Republicans than the Democrats. Of course, in that era, the Republicans were the progressives and the Democrats mm-hmm. were the conservatives. Mm-hmm. But even beyond that, you know, it's not like they were for the petty bourgeois reformers against the big capitalists. Not necessarily, right? They also saw big capital as progressive in a way that the, you know, middle-class reformers were not. The middle-class reformers were conservative reactionaries. So Debs himself, of course, comes out of the Democratic Party and the populist movement, but he breaks with it, right? He was mm-hmm. a William Jennings Bryan type guy, and he breaks very strongly with that. Very strongly.
Yeah, my point in this last video that I made, in that, and my the point that I want to make to people who are considering themselves anti-leftist today, is that without a concept of the left, you can't make these kinds of critiques that you're making now. If you don't have a concept of progress, without Marxism, yeah. Right, but, you know, but Marx believed that bourgeois freedoms were a step forward, you know.
Oh, historically, yes.
Yeah.
Probably
yeah. And I think we need to hold on to them. Like, that's why I like yes. Glenn Greenwald, right? You can't be a progressive if at the end of this trial of Chauvin, the cop who killed George Floyd, you say, why is the defense attorney arguing about, you know, the standards of doubt in this trial? Why isn't he arguing? Obviously, he's got a weak hand. He should be arguing that Chauvin is innocent and clearly doesn't believe it. This is like what the legal scholar at CNN said. It's like, no.
Oh, they're idiots. No, they're real idiots.
Yeah, right. But this is right. And Greenwald was, you know, appalled, of course.
The point is, a guilty person has rights against the state. The guilty right. have rights against the state, like, let alone the innocent, right? But the guilty,
right.
The reason that it's, the burden of proof is on the state to prove guilt, and why the defense does not have to prove innocence is that even if the defendant is guilty, they have rights, right? In other words, it's understood that putting someone in prison is taking away their rights. And so the system is supposed to be designed to make it as difficult as possible to take those rights away from people.
Right. I mean, and anybody on the left should know that. Or have some inclination in that direction.
No, they're social justice warriors. In other words, they know. And not only that, they're not only social justice warriors, but they're statists. They are. So they.
But at that point, they're not on the left anymore.
That's right.
They don't get to have that.
That's
label.
Well, I've been saying this for a long time. The left is dead, meaning the left is just the right. And it's because they're Democrats. And so the Democrats actually have, like, a rationale for their attitude, like a Maxine Waters, right? So the news of the day today is Maxine Waters. She's like violating the sanctity of the trial by saying we need this verdict. And if not, there's going to be like violence in the streets. Well, she's legitimate in saying that. In other words, like no trial takes place outside of a context. And there's a long history of like social and political pressure on trials. And a jury is susceptible to that. This whole idea that like the trial should be hermetically sealed and the jury should be sequestered, that's all bullshit. That's all like late tinkering with the system, you know, to make it into a kind of abstract, rational legal process. Whereas it was always understood constitutionally by the founders that this is a social and political process. In other words, that the jury represents the people and the jury is susceptible to the, like, in other words, if the jury wants to convict Derek Chauvin because they don't want riots, it's within their rights to do that.
Yeah. Right?
In other words, like to say, oh, well, that's like not legally correct. Well, the law doesn't exist in a vacuum. And the founders understood that. Like, it's only these like technocratic legalistic people who think that a court case exists in a vacuum as some kind of abstract legal exercise. It's not, because the jury is there to decide what the law means.
I tend to like that abstract legalistic mind.
No, you're thinking of it democratically. Like, the people decide what the law means. In other words, the legislators write the law, and it's more or less well-written. And, you know, like, I guess Supreme Courts, like, decide, like, the Constitution.
You know why I like it? You know why I like that abstract? Because when I've been on the job and the boss is after me, that abstract legalistic approach to whether or not I violated the rules was much better for me than the social power that I'm facing.
No, you need to back it up, though. If you can't back it up, then what you get is just who's the better sophist.
And so I was usually the better sophist.
You might have been personally, but what I'm saying is that generally speaking, the bosses are going to, they're going to have the resources to be the better sophists. In other words, it's like, you know, it's like these, like, I don't know, Title IX cases or whatever, right? It's like these, like, you know, procedures with respect to, like, you know, human resource departments and corporations. And, you know, like, they have some, like, legalistic procedure for how to handle this, that, or the other thing. But it's outcome driven. In other words, they know what they want from the process and they get the result that they want. They do, right?
And, yeah.
You know, and
well,
and
when I was at Comcast, I was not able to win. right. When I was at a little nonprofit organ, you know, at the Oregon Symphony with a boss who I knew, I was able to win out on the legalistic arguments from time to time.
Yeah, but it's different. Comcast, I mean, it's case by case, but you know, we just have to.
But understand. I did get unemployment because I could think legalistically and not like they wanted me to freaking sign that I had been fired with cause. Like, you know, yeah,
because they pay your unemployment. You know that.
Right. That's right. I realized, oh, they want me to sign away my right to unemployment right here in this room.
No, they themselves, if they lay you off, they have to pay your unemployment, at least part of it. The government pays part and the employer pays part.
Right.
Yeah.
I knew that.
No, I know. It's like, so, I mean, anyway, so the bottom line, and this maybe brings us around to the issue at hand, regression.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about regression for a little bit. We're kind of going long, but let's talk about it because I feel as though it's a very important point. And I worry that we've been regressing certainly for the last 20 years again and again and again. Like I saw when Trump was elected, what I worried about was how the New Deal, you know, the attempt to go back to the New Deal was suddenly the most radical thing on the agenda. It's like we, you know, and 3 years earlier, it was not. That was the right wing of the left that was always pushing that. And the left wing of the left had,
Little differently, which is that Barbara Ehrenreich, and she had a co-author who I'm forgetting. He's a leader of the FRSO, the Maoist organization. They wrote an article in The Nation magazine called The S Word. And it was in 2008, 2009, you know, there was like a kind of symposium in the pages of The Nation about like New New Dealism and the S word, the dirty S word, right? And the idea being that New New Dealism is going to be a step towards socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, so that was already happening.
That's right, a right-wing slur against the New New Deal that they're then now, you know, it's not true. Go ahead.
You know, Doug, I would say the right wing, like in the United States, the conservative liberals, the Republican type people, many of them might actually support socialism in terms of the original Marxist understanding of socialism. What they reject is progressive capitalist statism, and they have every good reason to reject that. That's what they reject. That's what they call socialism. That's what they call Marxism. So they call communism, because communism to them is like apparatchiks, right? And so I remember Trump saying something like, well, Bernie Sanders is a socialist, but Kamala Harris is a communist. And I thought, what the fuck is he talking about? He's not saying that Kamala Harris is to the left of Bernie Sanders in any substantial sense, other than meaning that the left just means statist. And he's like, Kamala Harris is even more an apparatchik type statist, a ruthless, like dictatorial statist than Bernie Sanders is. And you have to understand that that is what people think it is. That's what they think socialism is.
Yeah, but let me, I want to push back about that.
If they understood what it really is, they would support Marxism and socialism, because Marxism and socialism is against capitalist statism.
I agree with you, but I also have been talking to a Trump supporter on the regular lately.
I saw a conversation that you had with dude, and I'm not sure that he's a good representative.
Okay, perhaps not. He's the one that approached me, right?
Uh-huh.
So he's on the QAnon side of things.
He certainly isn't a good representative of Trump's own feelings.
Right. But what I would say is I think on the right, there's a hatred for statism some of the time, and then there's a love of it in other instances. So there's more of a love of the military and authoritarian control directly than there is on the left, whereas the left is like, you know, basically the way I think of it is the right likes the mean father and the left likes the loving mother, but they're both paternalistic and state-centric.
The avowed right, you know, they understand the legitimacy of the state in a certain way, and they support that to the hilt. In other words, they're like, you know, when it comes down to it, when you need a cop, the cop has to be able to do what he has to do, which is assert force. And when you need the military, then you need to just let them do what they do, which is fight. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, right, what they don't like is bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. In other words, if they see the cops and the military serving a bureaucratic interest, then they're against them. Right. In other words, they see the cops and the military as a necessary evil that should be glorified, because it's this dirty work of necessary evil that has to happen sometimes. And so when it has to happen, it has to happen. That's their attitude. In other words, when you say like, oh, we honor the military and their sacrifice, it's understood. These are people who are brutalized by having to be brutal. And so we should, like, you know, put this sentimental halo around them, because we understand they're doing something like that I myself wouldn't want to do. So it's like Trump, you know, he was a draft dodger. He doesn't want to be in the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't want to be a soldier. He doesn't want to sacrifice himself. He doesn't.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. Like, I totally think that is the right wing perspective. But nonetheless,
whereas the left is like, oh, actually, the cop should be a social worker, and that's like a noble profession. And it's like, fuck no.
Yeah, right.
Fuck no.
No, right. No, I agree. I agree. I prefer to know when I'm dealing with a cop than to not know.
You're dealing with force. In other words, you know, like people talk about being nervous around the police. Every time I see a cop, my heartbeat goes up a little bit. Like when I'm walking down the street and a cop car, you know, cruiser goes by and they slow down a little bit, and I know that they're like looking at me, looking at people on the street, I get a little nervous. Of course, because they are force. That's what they're for. They're violence. That's who they are.
But Michael Albert and Noam Chomsky, they don't like the social worker either, really. You know, that well, part of the anarchist
social worker.
Well, okay. When that point, then that's like everybody should own a gun.
No, no, that's not that, because they want people to be in everybody else's business. In other words, they really want like the ancient village, like they really want people to be all in each other's business, you know, and that's not the same thing as everyone should own a gun. Everyone should own a gun to defend themselves, not to police other people.
Right. Well, but everyone should be a cop. Is the other way to put it. Everyone should be a little cop that has that doesn't have a gun but has social influence as their weapon.
No, you should you know, have
the interdependence
people.
Of a
yeah, yeah, you but the village that's beat up the wayward member. In other words, like if somebody does something wrong, then everybody should go beat them up.
And it's yeah, like, but you don't want to see that. You don't want to see it. So beat them up slowly and bit by bit.
Oh yeah. You don't actually have to beat them up if you can just surround them and, you know, if you can do it like psychologically. Yeah. If you can just do it through moral pressure, you know.
But look, all of this is here's what I'm going to say in defense of both sides.
And the left thinks
that
that's right.
No one likes to deal with the necessity of mediating power.
Uh-huh.
Right. And the left, neither the left nor the right, really wants to deal with the necessity of mediating power. The right has an easier time of it, but they to do it have to glorify
it. And they have to pretend yeah. that capitalism doesn't exist.
Yeah.
They have to pretend that capitalism is somehow still bourgeois society, still like, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right. And whereas the left is quite happy to throw I don't want to say left, the progressives, let's call them the progressives. Okay. The status progressives. They are quite happy to throw the whole pursuit of bourgeois society to the side in the name of safety, in the name of a certain kind of equity, in the name of also not, you know, this isn't stated, but the maintenance of their own power. And that's, so
they,
that's,
they have their prerogatives. In other words, they do. And I mean, I think nowadays, you know, it's less about state power than it's about corporate and other forms of civil power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, I really see it as like the HR department. And, you know, the state, obviously, there's a lot of collusion. It's not like these things are really separate. They're not. They're the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's why, you know, like abolish the police or whatever. It's like, okay, abolish the police, but get ready for private security because they're going to be there. Right. And, you know, maybe they think that it should be private security, and maybe they think that private security forces should be subject to constant litigation, you know, or something. You know, so that when a private security person has to exercise force, that they're fully liable for, you know, lawsuits for what they do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, and that private security force, maybe that private security force is going to be black and Latino. You know, that's what it is. Like, if you look, you know, like who are the security guards at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago? They're black. Mm-hmm. Right. And why are they black? So that no one can accuse them of racism. That's why. In other words, because they have to keep, you know, the black homeless people in downtown Chicago off the property of the School of the Art Institute. And so you need to immunize yourself against the charge of racism. So you hire black people to do the dirty work of keeping the undesirable black people out.
Yeah, yeah.
So we could have that.
Yeah. And, you know, to me, it's a toss up as to which one's better. I don't really want to debate that. You know, like
the private security is worse. It is worse. It's worse.
It
because
is.
Because it's outside the realm of politics.
But it isn't really outside the realm of politics. That is a political decision.
Like,
yeah.
In other words, like the state saying we have a monopoly on the use of force and making police officers like legally, like, because if you're a police officer, you're a police officer 24/7, 365. And, you know, that means that you are entitled and also obligated to assert force. Like, in other words, if a police officer off duty sees a crime being committed, they are obligated to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're legally obligated. They also have the legal right to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, then the question is, how are they instructed to do so? What are the policies of the police department? How are they trained? And of course, ultimately, that's under the purview of an elected official. So it's under some political authority that can be disputed, that can be contested. You could have debates about it. You can have an election over it.
This is exactly the territory now, which we should push off into the Patreon only category. And there's two things about the Patreon only.
Turns our whole first hour into a huge teaser, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's a way to generate funds, and that's good. The other thing is it puts it behind a paywall so that we can speak more, maybe a little more freely.
I don't know. YouTube is going to censor that just as much, right?
Oh, no, I'm not worried about the YouTube algorithm when it comes to this stuff. I'm talking about audience, the left's response and how much shit I'm going to take and whether or not,
You know, nothing,
this is all parent room talk.
Nothing that I said or I'm going to say would get you in trouble with the left. It might confuse them, you know, because Chris Cotrone is some horrible right-wing Trumpist or whatever they think, you know. It might confuse them because they'd have a hard time disagreeing with anything that I say, right? But what and I think that you and I come to the same place, which is, okay, but what do we do about it now in practice?
Right. Yeah, and this is okay. I will say the my final thought on what we're discussing up to this point, and then we'll move over. I will leave this for the public, and I won't get so much crap from people who are saying, "Hey, Doug, you know that you petite bourgeois scum taking making us pay for this stuff." I've been thinking about the murder trial of Siobhan a little bit, and I was thinking, you know, regardless of the outcome for him. Clearly, we're in a moment where new standards need to be applied to the cops, because it seems to me like if we want to impose new standards on the cops, that means we're going to have to professionalize them and pay them more. We're going to have to they're going to treat them like nurses are treated, not like they have the same obligations as a nurse, but just like that level of professionalization. Like, okay, they should have been able to recognize that George Floyd was possibly in a medical event before they ever got him on the ground. They should have had the obligation to get there should have been a checklist of what to do in that kind of situation. And the first obligation should be, if he's no longer a physical threat, which he wasn't, to get him.
I mean, I would just say treatment. As long as you have people whose essential job is the assertion of physical force, people are going to die at their hands.
That's true. But that's true. Let me get to the end of my thought. So we want the cops to be more humane, but ultimately that can't be the final solution. You cannot get cops to be humane enough or to deal with the circumstances that the people are in that create inhuman circumstances. So,
well, that's just a roundabout way of saying you need to understand why there are cops and that you need Marxism for.
Right. So ultimately, no matter what level of solution we're looking at here, whether it's
there have not
punishing
cops, right? So just, you know, I know that you know this, but your audience may not. Cops only exist in the era of capitalism.
Right. So
industrial capitalism.
So abolishing the cops is a good goal, but how do we get there is a question. But my final thought was like, okay, to the degree to which we focus on this one cop, or even on fixing the cops.
You know, Adolf Reed said this. He said two things that are really important. He said, indictment is the first step to acquittal in these cases. And he also said it's a mistake to make it about single cases, because single cases are always complicated. And there are all sorts of factors, right? So beware the kind of cause celeb case. And of course, a trial is all about like making it as ambiguous as possible. In other words, like the defense's job is to make it as ambiguous as possible. In other words, to prevent conviction.
Right.
And that is often effective, and we should not be against defense attorneys being effective in that way.
Right.
So, you know, a trial is for the benefit of the defendant. It's not for the benefit of the state. It's not a place, you know, I always like to say Law and Order, like the show. You know, Jack McCoy said, the purpose of a trial is not justice. Justice is at best a byproduct.
Right. I was going to just say that too many people, whether they're progressives or right wingers, too many people feel as though we should be landing on justice and moral outcomes. And the reality is we should be trying to perfect society. We should be trying to change the conditions that produce different outcomes, because we're with the full realization that we're never going to get to the absolute justice or truth.
No. But you know, but if we understand that the role of the police is not to be just, but to assert force, and that the purpose of a trial is not to achieve justice, but to uphold the law. Mm-hmm. If we understand those two things, then we can be without illusions.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.